It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Daily show. Politics without the boring bits. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up on today's episode, the last one from the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, as Keir Starmer lays out his final pitch, he hopes, as leader of the opposition at a party conference. We take a look back at pre-election pitches in history, the ones that have worked, essentially Tony Blair, and the ones that haven't, everyone else. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do on a Tuesday, let's have a chat with these two.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
And as ever on a Tuesday, we are joined by Daniel Finkelstein. Morning, Danny.
Good morning. Can I just correct you, Matt, in your earlier statement that I hated Lib Dems? Obviously, not only is hate an alien an emotion to me, but I love Lib Dems so much that I don't want them to waste their time anymore on an independent party.
You've only got their best interests at heart.
Exactly.
So this is all a reference to a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago with Miranda Green, who's here. Morning, Miranda.
Good morning.
Former advisor to Paddy Ashdown.
Yes,
a long time ago.
Although I have to say, this conference season has been wonderful for those of us who are relics of the 1990s. There's been a lot of tearful and emotional reunions from that era, actually, because it has got that slight 97 vibe about it now, I would say.
But it's a 97 vibe with a lot of the people from 97.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I've been very boring at the parties, telling people my memories.
I don't believe that. We were in the same restaurant last night, weren't we?
We were. It's all very jolly.
The whole of Fleet Street seemed to be in the same restaurant. Anyway, Danny, why aren't you here?
Because, as you know, I've got a book out and I had a number of events that were planned in advance. I didn't realise Labour was coming after the Conservatives rather than before it.
So
I committed myself, so I had to go to it.
We'll let you off. We've all got books out, Danny.
We have. Very good. Yours is too, by the way, to everyone knows.
Well, that's very kind.
I'm the odd one out, aren't I? Better get on with it.
Have you not got a book?
No. I need to rectify that, didn't I?
Get on and write a book.
I know you won't be able to mention it on air, Matt. So I don't.
I know. It'd be really embarrassing if I said it was called Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors and came out on Thursday. 50 places that changed British politics. Definitely don't want to talk about that. Right, before we talk about party conference season, let's talk about the story. And quite often, you know, party conferences can be a bit of a bubble. There's a big thing going on elsewhere. And it's a really big thing right now. Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, warned the response to attacks from Hamas has only just begun. And we've seen thousands of people attending vigils and protests in London over the conflict. Pro-Palestinian protesters rallied outside the boarded-up Israeli embassy in Kensington last night, chanting, "Israel is a terrorist state and free Palestine," while letting off flares and fireworks. Foreign Secretary James Cleverly was asked about this by Sky News this morning, about whether pro-Palestinian protesters in London should just stay at home.
You know, I would suggest that they do. There is no requirement for this. This is a difficult and delicate situation, and increasing fear. And these protests, beyond no illusion, are causing a huge amount of distress for people in the Jewish community in the UK who have often been at the receiving end of prejudice and threats of violence. There's no need for this at all, and I would encourage them just to pause. This is a delicate and difficult situation, and this isn't helping.
What do you think, Danny? Should supporters of Palestine stay at home now?
Well, look, There are two things that these people that are protesting are the statements they're making by coming out. And they have to decide whether they want to make these statements. The first is that they approve, they think is justified, the killing of innocent civilians and the mutilation of bodies, the raping of women, the hostage taking. That's what inevitably, by timing your protest at this moment, you're saying you think that is justified by the situation. And the second, they're making a statement that's always very difficult to counter, because they say free Palestine. And I personally, of course, want Palestinian aspirations for a state to be recognised, and I want every human being to be free. But if they mean by free Palestine that they're going to eradicate the state of Israel or reduce Israel's security to the point where such murders as the ones that have taken place in the last few days are going to take place on a regular basis, which is the reason why Israel has the protection and security that it does and cannot accord to its neighbouring people the freedom that they ask for, because at the moment that freedom would result in violence. If they want to make those two statements, they can come out and protest. It's not illegal in this country, fortunately, to do that. But I think James Cleverly is correct in advising them that neither of those things are statements they should want to make.
I mean, actually, there is a question of the law and legality around supporting Hamas, which is a prescribed terror organisation. And, you know, exactly what you're chanting and where you're chanting it might fall into that. What do you think, Miranda?
It's very tricky, isn't it? Because there's always the danger. I mean, we've all already seen really horrible examples of anti-Semitic attacks on Jewish businesses, Jewish restaurants in the UK. There's always the danger of a sort of, you know, contamination from something horrific happening in the Middle East. But I think you know, it's interesting what Danny says, and I think the problem is that you have to remind people that the mission of these organizations is to wipe Israel from the map. It's not a case of normal relations between neighboring countries who then have sort of conflict over territory. So, you know, it is a kind of unique problem in the world. And so it's right to remind people that those protests are actually supporting a cause which is to eliminate the state of Israel. So, you know, and I think that does make it different. That makes
quite,
it different,
quite right,
different
Miranda,
qualitatively different protest.
Absolutely. And 45% of Jews in the world now live in Israel. And one of the reasons that Israel was created was to try to have a safe haven in the world after centuries in which there wasn't a safe haven in the world for Jews. And unquestionably, this has resulted in Israel having, an extremely difficult relationship with its neighbours, which has involved itself in robust security measures. And, you know, some people have sort of suggested, are these security measures disproportionate? And what's happened over the last few days is that it's been proven that they were not disproportionate, that the aim was, in fact, to kill innocent civilians in large numbers in order to make a political point. And, you know, people who want to come out and protest are making a statement that they favour that. And actually, obviously there's always this balance. Do you want people to come out on the street and say something appalling? What should the law say about that? Actually, I think if they want to discredit themselves in that way, we're all learning something. And, I don't think I should interrupt my enemy when they're making an error.
Isn't it also, though, so sad? I mean, watching the sort of some of the explainers on the TV news last night, when you see those pictures of the Oslo peace accords and the kind of moments of hope that there have been in recent history about finding a two-state solution, getting the more reasonable nations in the region to recognise Israel and, you know, establish diplomatic... that we seem to be so far away from that again now.
It's so awful.
And that's sort of separate from the utter horror of watching what's actually unfolded there.
It was interesting. We had Sadiq Khan was on the show yesterday, and he was saying that, you know, as night follows day, this will lead to an increase in anti-Semitic attacks in London. It just will, because it always does. And he was, you know, depressed about that and working with the police and so on. But also, ultimately, you know, Mark Drake was on the show yesterday. He said that the two-state solution is even further away than it has been for a very long time, perhaps ever. And yet that is still the only solution.
I think...
Israel and Palestine have to exist side by side.
For those people who are listening to this, who take the view, they're very sympathetic to the Palestinian aspirations for a nation state, and they're very sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinian people, what I would urge is that you interrogate what people mean when they say or they are pro-Palestinian or they are for free Palestine. If what they mean is they want a separate state living alongside Israel in the partition proposed by the United Nations in the middle 1940s as a result of the experiences of both people, then I think it's there's no problem to say, yes, you know, you support that aspiration. But if by that they're making the suggestion, which I think a lot of them are, that there ought to be no Israel, this is millions of Jewish people who would be open to the kind of thing that's happened over the last few days. And Jewish people are simply, I mean, two things. Not only ought they not to, but are not going to allow that to happen again. This is what every time we meet on Holocaust Memorial Day, and we finish with that statement, never again. This is what never again means, literally not allowing this situation to happen now. And this is a challenge for everybody who has a sympathy, which I completely understand, for Palestinian people, thinks themselves as being pro-Palestinian. Please advise other people who are pro-Palestinian. It has to be alongside Israel, safe in a safe state of its own, alongside a safe Israeli state. And if it isn't, it amounts to an attempted genocide against Jewish people, which has happened before and we cannot allow to happen again.
The other thing we should reflect, Miranda, is that there are people who are very passionate on both sides. There are an awful lot of people listening to this, who will just be thinking, I just don't understand this. And just looking at it as a human nightmare with what's been playing out in Israel, through no fault of the individual people taken from their homes or a music festival, whatever it might be, in exactly the same way that then the individuals going about their business in Gaza. You know, there's a human story here. And I think there'll be lots of people listening who think...
Well, that's why we call it terrorism,
understand
right?
Exactly. I don't really understand it. I don't really want to get involved because I'm going to say the wrong thing. Or, you know, and I think it's a thing that, you know, because of the nature of the programmes that we do and newspaper columns, it's always the people who've thought about it a lot and have very strong positions. There are lots of people viewing this as a dreadful human story.
Well, it is, and the individual human stories are absolutely horrific. I mean, the news is very, very difficult to watch at the moment. But also, you know, that's why it's called terrorism, right? Because the impact of targeting civilians in an utterly ruthless way is so great, and it's a gut punch to your enemy and your opponent, and it gets attention. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes terrorism works because it sort of pushes either the international community or domestic authorities or whatever towards some change
some
of position.
Of
and of
for.
Course the concern here is that the terrorist atrocities will push the sort of retaliation from Israel which then escalates the whole thing, and it becomes unmanageable.
Well, I mean, the news is grim, and the big fear is it's quite obviously going to get worse, I think.
But it has been really noticeable here, hasn't it, at Labour conference. And, I mean, about 25 Labour people must have said to me yesterday, just imagine what this conference would have been like if Jeremy Corbyn was still in charge of our party. You know, there was that Corbyn leadership speech when the hall was full of Palestinian flags, you know, not Labour flags or the Red Rose. And here we are this week with a completely united Labour leadership, and in fact even the conference as a whole, you know, almost no dissent from solidarity
with Israel, a very small protest outside yesterday.
And I mean, that is a huge change in 3-4 years.
And the crucial thing was this was not by Jeremy Corbyn simply support for Palestinian people's self-determination. It was opposition to the existence of Israel. It was support, as he has made perfectly clear, for Hamas. And he made clear that he regarded them not as a terrorist force, but as a legitimate voice of aspiration of the Palestinian people. And that aspiration was to go, you know, when you ever hear somebody say to all the way to the sea, what that means is drive the Jews into the sea. And it's so important to people who want, and I completely understand this, who want to understand and to empathise with the aspirations of Palestinian people who associate themselves with taking a Palestinian stance, who are often critical of Netanyahu's government. That is not the same thing as Hamas want. That's not the same thing. Yeah. It's not what they're fighting for. And so if people don't need to understand it very much, all they need to understand is We've got to find a solution in which the Jews and the Palestinians are able to share the land in Palestine with Palestinian state and Israel, and they can live safely alongside each other. It doesn't require much understanding.
Right, here we are then. Miranda's here, Danny isn't. But at various points, we have been together and apart at the party conferences. What have you learned over the last 3 weeks about the state of the nation's political parties, Miranda?
Okay, so what I've learned is, number one, I'm not as young as I was, and at the end of 3 weeks, I really want to go home now. But apart from that, I think it has been really fascinating, and I'm really glad I've slogged around all three, actually, because the mood that you pick up, I think, is crucial to working out what's going on. Number one, the question has to be, you know, is Labour actually ready? And they're doing a pretty good job of answering that question in a positive way. Rachel Reeves' sort of barnstorming speech yesterday felt like a real moment when she was taking on the kind of aura of someone who almost was already in charge. Whether Keir Starmer can quite match that today, we will see. And then the Conservative Party last week, you know, I thought some of the coverage really overplayed the kind of Tea Party tendency. You know, they're not in control of the Tory Party yet. And you would have got that impression, I think, if you hadn't been there in Manchester. There was a lot of government stuff going on. But there was that feeling of how much have they got left in the tank, to use that Jacinda Ardern, you know, phrase. And since they're the friend of the motorist at the moment, I think it's fair enough to go with that. And, you know, you felt that even if they're not completely out of kind of governing fuel, could they make it through another 5 years? You know, they're definitely in the red. Where's the new fuel coming from? Either people or policies?
I think that's sort of the Tea Party right-wing tendency thing. The reason you might have got the impression they were in charge is because they were just more interesting. You know,
yeah, they got a lot of attention, absolutely.
They got annoyed, you know, because Liz Truss and Priti Patel and Nigel Farage singing and all of that is colourful and entertaining rather than some pretty dire, thin speeches laid out in the conference hall. It wasn't that they were driving the government agenda. They were just upstaging them, really, by being slightly more eye-catching. Well, Danny, what's been your reading of the conference season?
It's obviously eye-catching if you can make statements that don't have to accord to a reality or what you're able to do, as Liz Truss demonstrated. I mean, it's obvious that the Conservative Party has stepped away from rather than towards the right, because this year the speech was being given by Rishi Sunak and not by Liz Truss, who had to give her speech on the fringe. So I think Miranda was completely right. I did sometimes feel with the coverage, which was sort of odd for me, that a lot of journalists had come there and couldn't believe that the Conservative Party conference was full of Conservatives. And, you know, saying Tory things where about controlling immigration and not increasing taxes and controlling public spending. Therefore, because the narrative is the Tory Party is going to lose the next election, which is a narrative I sort of share. There was everything that somebody said from the platform was regarded as kind of slightly mad or useless or incompetent. And then everything that said in opposition to that sounds fantastic. Actually, I think the gap between how fantastic they were is not anywhere near as great as the coverage. However, I did think what was interesting about the Conservative Party conference is that it wasn't very full. That is because partly because party conferences are full of people who are not actually party members, generally, on both sides, and all of that action was at Labour because people expect Labour to get elected. I think it's reasonable to say there didn't seem to be much sort of coherent narrative and energy behind the Tory message. I'm quite interested in Rishi Sunak going for this time for a change idea, whether he's going to be able to sustain that. I mean, in my column, I rather doubted it. I do think they've centred on a very good way of attacking Keir Starmer, which is basically true, that he doesn't know what he stands for. If I were him, though, in his speech, I wouldn't try and address it. I would simply stick with the reassurance message. It's obviously working for him, so it'll be interesting. So I would kind of note the Tory attack, realise it probably isn't on the right weakness of Keir Starmer, but not try to address it if I were him.
The other thing I thought, sort of comparing the two, was the sort of enduring importance of the speech and getting a good speechwriter and being able to perform and project character and the
That's
sense
really
of being ready
and
you know, and having the kind of cojones, I suppose, to take on the work of government. And I did feel at the Tory conference it was interesting that Suella Braverman's speech, which shocked so many people, and I did think some of it was pretty shocking in terms of the immigration language, was a very well-crafted speech, unfortunately. And she'd put the effort in. So whatever she's planning for the future of Suella Braverman, she's taking it seriously. I didn't feel that the corresponding balancing wing of the Tory party, the moderates, as it were, if their plan is to not let their party, after a potential defeat, zoom off crazily to the right, they need to get some people in place, they need to get some strategy, they need to get some speechwriters, so they can also get up on stage and say, well, actually, we have a set of British conservative values to rival Suella's vision, and it's this. And there was nobody really doing that. And I do feel that's a problem for the Tory moderates. And then you come here and you see a fantastic performance from Rachel Reeves. Labour takes this speechwriting thing very seriously, as I know you'll be picking over it later. It's important. You've got to project to the nation what it is you're actually offering.
I don't think we should underplay the significance of Rachel Reeves' speech yesterday.
Indeed.
I've sat through a lot of Rachel Reeves' speeches over the years, during the Ed Miliband time and all that, and you wouldn't rush in. Quick, everyone, gather your belongings. Rachel Reeves is about to speak.
Because yesterday, you think she... Yeah,
you
think she's
going to
win, though, don't you? Isn't it?
Well, I think there's also a personal aura that's now around her.
It was just, she was better crafted. Basically, it had all the hallmarks for Gordon Brown's speech.
I mean, I hate to say it, but it was quite prime ministerial.
Yeah.
So I actually think Keir Starmer's job today is that little bit harder for him.
I bumped into her last night and said, I like the way you rode the waves of applause. She did the thing that Gordon Brown used to do, was it, well, you deliver your line and people clap, and rather than waiting for the clapping to stop, you just shout over them, and you just keep shouting, and they keep clapping, and you keep shouting, and before you know it, they're all up on their feet, and they can't really remember why.
But I do think at these party conferences, as you go towards winning, you pull in better people to help, and clearly you also realise you're on the verge of victory, and it gives you energy to prepare it. And I did think, I do agree with you. I thought it was well crafted, and my view of these things is they take a lot of work over a long period of time to do a good speech, and you've experienced that too, Miranda. I've worked on
lots. It's a hellish process.
It's really awful, and it really is awful, and you don't emerge for days, but you do spend forever on them, but if you go through every sentence and every line, work on it, it does make a big difference. But I think the other thing, though, is it makes a big difference if the hall is full, the atmosphere is with you. And Suella Braverman did have a well-crafted speech, but it was, Alex Chalk before her also did. He just didn't have the kind of hall's energy with them, because the Conservative Party membership, without any question, it elected Liz Truss, and that's still probably where it is, and therefore you're going to be able to get more energy back from the hall if you are in that area. And the same's true for Rachel Reeves. So it, to some extent, is about narratives as well as about the actual craft of the speech.
We should talk about the parties who bookend this conference season. The Lib Dems. It feels like about 2 years ago now. Is it 2 weeks ago?
It was 2 years ago, Matt. Yes, we're 2 years older, definitely, that's for sure.
I feel it. 2 weeks ago, and then we've got the SNP this weekend.
Mm.
And their fate, both seem in the balance. The Lib Dems could, go from whatever it is, 15 MPs now. Maybe they'll get to 20, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll suddenly get 30 or 40, and that will surprise everyone. And then similarly, we've seen in the Glen By election last week, the SNP, if they are in retreat in Scotland, as the polls suggest, that suddenly makes the whole calculation of what happens at the general election. What happens to those two parties is also really important, albeit we're not quite obsessing about them in as much detail.
Well, so, absolutely, in terms of where the numbers fall, Danny? It's going to be crucial.
But the other thing that the SNP is telling you is that you can't be in power forever. And at a certain point, time for a change comes in. And we all ascribe that to different things that the SNP is doing to do with caravans and pub party finance, and that the Tories are doing to do with parties and Liz Truss. But actually, in fact, it's just after a while, the pendulum effect gets you. And then we all create a narrative to explain what's really just over time, the accretion of people being opposed to it. And you can see it, because here is Labour winning against two completely different opponents with no correlation between them whatsoever, both experiencing the same problem. And the only thing that the two have in common is they've both been in power for a long time. And so it does rather suggest that some of our narrative is trying to explain a phenomenon that just happens over and over again.
It's just a concept of time.
I think that is absolutely true, but I do think there's a big difference between the kind of English picture and the Scottish picture, because in Scotland there's a kind of natural floor below which the SNP vote probably won't go because of support for independence, whereas in England it feels really quite volatile. And I think several sophologists that I was chatting with in Bournemouth were saying the same thing to me, Matt, which I think I may have said to you before, so apologies over the 2 years I've occasionally repeated myself, which is, you know, it's so volatile that you could end, you know, all these outcomes are possible, right through from hefty landslide, which massively ups the number of Lib Dems as a kind of corollary of that, you know, or a narrow win and the Lib Dems still stuck on sort of, you know, 20 or so. But the electorate can sort of, you know, turn like on a sixpence at the moment, as we know from recent...
And that's what makes it so exciting, not being a foregone conclusion.
Miranda Green from the Financial Times, and of course, Danny Finkelstein from the Times. You can read him every week with your Times subscription. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, how do you make your last pitch to the public?
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Keir Starmer using his big speech at the Labour Party conference to lay out his, what he hopes will be his final pitch to the public ahead of a general election.
People are looking at us because they want our wounds to heal, and we are the healers. People are looking to us because these challenges require a modern state, and we are the modernisers. People are looking to us because they want to build a new Britain, and we are the builders.
So how does it compare to others? It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
So, Keir Starmer making what could be his last party conference speech before the next general election, with a long checklist he needed to work through, prove to his party and the public at large that he's ready to be the next Prime Minister. But what can he learn from his predecessor's pre-election speeches? Let's speak to Phil Collins, Times columnist and former chief speechwriter for Tony Blair, a man, in fact, the only Labour man for a very long time who's successfully done a pre-election conference speech. Good to see you, Phil.
Yeah, good to be here. Yeah, it's a big moment, as you say. I mean, exactly what you just set out is what he needs to do, is to demonstrate he's going to be the Prime Minister.
And we've got Times Radio's Aisha Azarika, who worked for Ed Miliband, who didn't.
All right.
I'm sorry about that. Right, we're going to wind back a bit further. Let's go back to 1991, when Neil Kinnock had already fought and lost the general election in 87, but had another go. The polls suggested that he might be on course to become Prime Minister. And in his final Labour Party conference speech in 1991, ahead of the 92 election, he talked about the failures of UK public services compared to our European neighbours.
People look at the state of our society, and they look at our neighbours in the rest of the European community. They see the high standards of training, the quality of childcare, the investment in public transport, and they ask, why not here? Why not here in Britain? And the answer is, we can change. We can do it here with a Labour government.
It's interesting, Phil. The opposition often get accused of being very good on the diagnosis that Britain is broken or things aren't working, but turning that into a solution to those problems is more difficult.
Yeah, it is. And Kinnock is a study, really, in the limitations of these speeches, because he was magnificent at them. You know, just in that short clip, the voice, the resonance, the rhythm, it's really good, technically, for a piece of writing. And he did some famously magnificent Labour Party conference speeches, but they weren't enough to take him into Downing Street. And it's partly because of the lack of policy, but it's also there was something about his authority which was somehow lacking. People did not see him as a prime minister, rightly or wrongly, they just didn't. And that's a very significant barrier. It's hard to overcome. You can't really talk your way over it. And if you could have done, Kinnock is the one man in our lifetime of British politics who would have been able to do so, but he wasn't able to.
And why not? Because we put a lot of stall on speeches, Aisha. And Neil Kinnock was clearly a great speech. I mean, you need all of the elements. You need great policy, you need a great team, you need a lot of luck, you need timing to be on your side. But actually being able to communicate to the public is really important.
It is. And look, you know, the speech, I think, as well, has changed a lot. Because I think back in the day as well, the sort of Neil Kinnock era, it was very much about a big moment in the room and that big performance in the room with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of activists there. It was like a real kind of an electrifying moment. It felt like as an activist, you had to be in the room. And also, remember, this is pre-social media. This is pre... And I think in a way, I think when you look back on some of those speeches where the oratory was amazing, it was real, they still were very much speaking to people in the hall. I think as time has gone on, particularly under Tony Blair, he and his team really realised the room is only part of the story. You're trying to really get into the television screens in their living room. Yeah. Now you're trying to really get into the palm of people's hands with the social media clip. Let's be honest, right? Very few people, no matter how good or bad Keir Starmer's speeches say, very few people will sit down. It's probably going to be an hour, right? These things normally are. Very few people will strap themselves in and sit, right, I'm going to dedicate an hour to this. So I think the nature of the performance and what that has to do for you has changed a lot as well.
It just struck me, Phil, considering he was only ever leader of the opposition, there's an awful lot of sort of Neil Kinnock speech moments, probably far more than any other leader of the opposition, because he, you know, whether it's a Labour council sending taxis scuttling around Liverpool where we are right now, you know, why was I the first Kinnock to go to university?
Biden famously stole.
Amazing moments.
Because he had an issue. Kinnock had a really important issue, which was the health and survival of the Labour Party. And he spoke about it brilliantly, and he was the perfect person to do it, because he came from the Labour left. He was deeply rooted in the Labour Party, and he was thought of as an apostate by those on the left, because he understood that Labour needed to move in order to be a party of government. Now, he couldn't go all the way, but that issue was incredibly emotionally engaged in the Labour Party, exactly as Aisha says, in the hall. It was electric. And he was doing the first phase that you always have to do when you've gone into opposition, which is to recover. And Kinnock was doing that, and it was very difficult because, in part, around this part of the world, there was a lot of activism within the Labour Party that was, in Kinnock's view, not helpful to get into government. Yeah. So that issue gave him something to talk about. It's quite common that you get to conference, you haven't really got anything to say. Kinnock always had something to say.
I also think as well, Neil Kinnock was quite unusual in the sense that he was such a gifted orator. Like, as you say, that beautiful, beautiful voice. He kind of loved the art of oratory and performing. I mean, if anything, you know, it was quite hard to get Neil to stop. So when I got my MBE at the party afterwards, Neil did the speech. It was me and this other guy, Greg, we both got on, and Neil came and did the speech. And at one point, Glenys was literally like dragging him off, wrestling the microphone off.
John Major said a brilliant thing about Kinnock, which is cruel but brilliant. He said that the reason Kinnock talks so much is that he doesn't know what he's trying to say, so he doesn't know when he's finished.
But he is this, like, he loves performing, right? Yeah. He absolutely, and he's very wonderful at it as well.
And actually, I'm, you know, maybe a bit unfair saying, well, it didn't work, did it? Because he didn't become Prime Minister. But it's a bit like, you know, William Hague was very good at doing PMQs. He didn't become Prime Minister, but it might have been worse if he hadn't, you know.
Yes.
That actually some of those skills might have, you know, without them, they could have been even worse.
Exactly. We can't expect it to take you all the way. It's only a speech. And as Aisha says, not everybody is watching.
There's a lot of work that needs
there's
to be done.
There's a lot more things
besides. But in the same way with, like, Kinnock, and Hague's a really good example of that for PMQs, it might not have moved the needle that much of the electorate, but I think it gave activism, it gave the party some self-respect back. And I think never underestimate the art of political communication. Like, it doesn't get you all the way, but the kind of feel-good factor, and it just makes you feel good about the party
and
again.
The absence of it could be worse.
There's a very good book on parliamentary questions, I gather, isn't there? I read.
Action Duty Politics, available at all bookshops.
There's a very good book on speechwriting.
Well,
as well,
thank you, Matt. I think we've done our work here now.
There's a very good book about to come out.
There's a very good book coming out this week as well about the 50 places that changed British politics, but we don't want to talk about that now. Let's turn our attention to the only Labour leader in a very long time who has gone from opposition into government. Let's go back to 1996, Tony Blair's pre-election conference speech, which, you know, is probably best remembered for focusing on one policy in particular.
Ask me my three main priorities for government, and I tell you, education, education, and education. And I tell you my vision of the future. I would like a state education system in Britain so good, so attractive, that the parents choose to put behind us the educational apartheid of the past, private and state. And I don't believe anything would do more to break down the class divides that have no place in a modern country in the 21st century.
Education, education, education. The original three-word slogan, Phil.
Yeah, not one of mine. Jonathan Powell, I think, claims credit for that one. It's interesting listening to that again now. The texture of Blair's voice is really, I've always thought, very strange. High, very unlike anybody else in the Labour Party. He's not a Labour Party rhetorician at all. That's definitely part of his appeal. But then the message, incredible clarity. You know, you get there and he actually asks the question that others are asking of him. If you ask me what are my three priorities, I mean, Keir Starmer could do worse than to do something similar. And then an interesting response, because it's one word repeated. It then struck me that actually that didn't turn out to be the three top priorities of the government, did it, really, in the end? So again, it shows you the limits of this. It creates a moment. It definitely does give the party a spring in its step. It's definitely part of creating your credibility as a political leader, but it's not really all that much of a promissory note for the future, because events intervene and other things will happen. So it's something which is rooted in the moment, and it is important in defining who you are, but it's not really quite the thing that defines you in the end, because the world intrudes.
But also, I suppose, as a reminder, Aisha, if you want to land a message, I mean, the whole point of saying his priority was education was it wasn't Labour infighting, it wasn't putting up taxes, it was, you know, bread and butter, schools and your kids and the future, and all that's bad up in education. In a way that if Rishi Sunak last week, you know, what are my three priorities? Cancelling HS2, something to do with exams,
bins.
And some children
and
not
smoking.
Yeah. And that doesn't, I mean, they're all, you know, you can argue about the merits of them all individually, but it's a bit like, well, it's almost like a weird shopping list. It's, you know, when you find yourself at the checkout and you've got, like, you know, washing up liquid, sellotape and a bunch of flour. It's like, you know, you might need them all, but it doesn't tell me anything about what you're planning to do.
And so much of this is about telling a story. I love that kind of rant. It's like the Aldi sick middle. I've got a canoe and a sort of fishing rod.
I was just trying to work out what you could do with washing up sellotape and a bunch of flour.
Yeah. That's a game show. Yeah. Matt, that's another challenge for you right there. But no, you're right. So much of this is about telling a story. And I think... I think what's so interesting is that, like, the one fight that the Labour Party has really lent into is just, I've just scribbled down, listening to that education, education, education. The fact that Labour is picking this fight over VAT and private schools, I think you need kind of... Labour can't commit to too much at this stage, and from what I've been told, I'm sure you've heard that, there's going to not be a big policy rabbit from the hat. But what they need is a couple of things, like education, which gets the blood pumping for people. They need one or a couple of things that people understand. It's It's emotional. It kind of quickens the pulse. And it's a bit of a row. And so that really reminded me of hearing that.
It also provides you with a thread for the speech. So when you're writing these speeches, the big problem you've got is because you're trying to encompass subjects that you don't normally have to go into. You've got to find a single idea which somehow allows you to talk about education, foreign policy, the army, net zero, housing, and of course these things are rather like washing up liquid and sellotape. They're not really, in fact, all that connected. But you've got to find an idea that makes them seem logical. Yeah. And that's the big challenge for a writer of doing this speech. And in that speech that we just heard, the pre-97 speech, he did that because education and modernization was the theme. Yeah. The country has fallen behind and needs to be modernized again. And that was the theme that Blair had. It's also the theme that Wilson had and the theme that Attlee had. And Starmer himself has used it.
And also, just speaking to Peter Manson over the weekend, he made the point, you know, there's this big debate about kind of caution versus, you know, how bold he can be. He actually said, look, in the run-up to 1997, if you actually really look back at the pledge card stuff, a lot of that's quite lean in actual sort of detail and policy. But what they did was they crafted this narrative that did feel optimistic, fresh, exciting, that change was coming. And so much of the art of politics and communication is about storytelling rather than here are like the raw numbers about this.
I was struck yesterday when Rachel Reeves kept repeating, Labour is ready to serve, ready to lead, ready to rebuild Britain. She kept doing it. Every time she did, it got a bigger round of applause over again. Well, let's now remind ourselves of a pre-election speech by a Labour leader. This was Gordon Brown in 2009, setting out his stall. Obviously, he was already Prime Minister, but about to fight his first election, trying to be defiant in the face of the global economic crisis that was really hitting Labour in the polls.
Our country faces the biggest choice for a generation. So we need to fight, not bow out, not walk away, not give in, not give up, but fight. Fight to win for Britain.
I mean, he was a good speech maker.
He was. He was an old-fashioned speech maker, really. But he was good. Yeah, absolutely. And I love that formulation. It's the biggest election for a generation. I long for someone to say, this one doesn't matter so much.
We can sit this one out.
It doesn't matter, really. He was a good speaker, but he was quite an indigestible speaker. You know, he wasn't light. His voice is gravelly and strong, and it works in some circumstances and not in others. It doesn't work brilliantly on TV. It works much better in the hall. It works when he's got a big subject. So, for example, when he spoke on the financial crash, his incredible credentials and authority and intelligence then came through, and he was immensely impressive in those moments. Not so much a modern campaigner. But also, I think, it shows that you can't talk your way out of a problem. I mean, any government which has been in place when the financial system collapses is going to struggle. And I don't think there's much you can say beyond, it's troubled times, please don't take a risk. I mean, that's all you can do at that point, and that's what he did.
Yeah.
I mean, Gordon Brown, I think, is an amazing communicator, but his style is very son of the manse, right? You know, Gordon Brown is at his best in like a massive old kind of church sort of building with like 600...
Which he did during the, I think, during the 2010 election, but also during the Scottish referendum.
Yes, during the referendum. Almost like a sort of cathedral with like about sort of 600 people there, and he is absolutely kind of brilliant at that sort of, you know, Phil will know this very well from Labour politics, there's a particular type of speaker that does kind of old-time religion for a Labour audience, and it is absolutely captivating, and it's like kind of political poetry. But you're so right, you put him in a different setting. I remember being in the run-up to the 2010 general election campaign, and things were going really bad. We just lost a by-election in Glasgow. It was kind of like curtains. It was just really, really bad. And we went to the National Policy Forum, and it must have been about 45 degrees. It was absolutely baking. We were in a room with so much static electricity and heat every day. And Gordon was meant to do sort of like a quick 10, and like 45 minutes later, the entire room, and we're in this really modern building in this and it's just meant to be a quick G up the troops, right? We've got a lot of work to do.
So he worked
and it's like, son of the manse giving like a big sermon.
Yeah, he loved that, and he was very good at it. I mean, Blair was much less good at that and didn't enjoy doing it. I mean, Blair, as Roy Jenkins brilliantly said, climbed up the building from the outside. Blair didn't like particularly the rallying cry, which is part of the conference rhetoric, and he wasn't that good at it. And whereas Brown was fantastic at it. He
but then it goes back to that thing about who is the audience. So Blair was better at speaking out to the country, and Brown was better at G-ing up the troops inside.
Well, up next, a good combination.
Well, that's why they were a good combination, yeah. You're going to love this next bit, Aisha.
Oh,
we are going back to 2014, the last Labour conference before the 2015 general election. The only thing in politics that anyone was talking about was the deficit and the need to bring it down, and the accusation that the Conservatives had a long-term economic plan and Labour was uninterested in the deficit. So Ed Miliband decided to do his speech without notes. He wanted to talk a lot about togetherness, but then forgot to mention the deficit. Let's take a listen.
Together. Together. Together we can restore faith in the future. Together we can build a better future for the working people of Britain. Together we can rebuild Britain. Friends, together we can.
Together, all together, apart from remembering all together the bit on the deficit. Here is Ed Miliband the day after his big speech, when he had to do a sort of whatever's the opposite of a victory lap is, as he went on every news outlet to explain why he forgot the deficit. Here he is on the BBC.
With the deficit paragraph,
sure.
Because it's printed, isn't
sure,
it?
Sure.
Did you forget that paragraph?
Yeah, I didn't do one part of the speech and I added in other bits.
Aisha.
I'm literally triggered. I'm actually having a stroke. Why are you doing this to me? I'd like to put a complete into HR, please, kind of thing. Look, it was just a really, really awful moment because... So there have been a couple of kind of weird speeches, just to give you the context back in Liverpool. So the first speech when Ed won was really quite difficult because as soon as he won against David, very, very controversial, red Ed.
Beating his brother David Moran.
So that was like first year, it was really, really difficult. And then he wanted to make a sort of big policy speech later and did the speech called Predators versus Producers.
Oh, that
producers.
Was in Liverpool, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was, I remember very well. And look, the kind of premise was a good one. It was about, you know, good capitalism versus bad capitalism. It's a debate that lots of people are having. But that's quite a big idea to land in a sort of conference speech. The next speech he did, a One Nation speech, which actually went down very, very well. And, you know, he was much more trying to speak to the country at that point, which is the right thing to do. And I think because that one had gone on quite well, and his trick was he's very good memory and, you know, I want to walk around sort of and not be kind of, you know, fettered and hemmed in by the lectern. So decided to sort of memorise it. We had rehearsed it so many times. We were going to use various theatres across London and we're having to negotiate with the theatre, let us in late at night. It was a lot of kind of prep going on. And we rehearsed that speech so many times and he had always got it word perfect until the big moment. And we were all kind of stood there and because we all practically remembered it word for word as well. And we were like, all the advisors were kind of like reaching for each other's hands and going, oh my goodness, what's happened? I can't believe. And it was just the worst bit to leave at. Because as you say, the political frame and the context, which can't trust Labour on the economy, they don't care about
if
the
deficit. If he'd forgotten any other bit,
yeah, totally.
It wouldn't have been remembered. If he'd forgotten the army,
if he'd forgotten the whole
rivers.
Of it, it would have been better. If he'd only said that bit.
What's the point, Phil, of doing that trick of the because David Cameron pulled it off in 2007 when he was basically trying to stop Gordon Brown calling a general election in Blackpool. I remember it well. The what's it called? The gardens. The what's
the winter gardens.
Winter gardens of Blackpool. And he took his watch off and he put it down and he said, "It might be messy, but it's me." But he did have some notes on his table. I think literally some bullet points to make sure
he did. But what he was doing with that speech, Cameron, was saying, "I'm new. I'm different." Because if you read that speech again, and I have since, there's nothing in it. But you have to watch it, because it does, the style of delivery does say, I'm not like the wooden David Davis, who's my rival for this job. I'm a brand new type of Conservative, and the method of my delivery is a sort of metaphor for that. So that's what it does. It says, I'm looser, I'm younger, I'm different. And so at a certain time in your development, it's no bad thing. I mean, I understand why he wanted to do it. I think the speech that Ed had done the year before, the One Nation speech, had been excellent. Yeah. It was really well written, and it was interesting because they took a notion that's normally a Conservative idea, and he wrestled it from them.
Yeah.
And I thought that
in
was
Manchester,
actually,
where the One Nation,
Disraeli,
yeah.
That's right.
One Nation speech.
I mean, it was clever, and it was interesting. So therefore, I felt at the time, this is not just all the wisdom of retrospect, that he needed to develop and become bigger in stature as a politician, and therefore standing behind a podium and just doing it conventionally was exactly what he should have done. I didn't really anticipate, of course, that he'd then forget part of it, but I felt it was a mistake for him to do that in any case
and
at
also,
that point.
I think the other thing about, just to for Ed's kind of rise through politics. So, you know, Ed and David were in politics at the same time. David sort of got kind of promoted a wee bit faster than Ed, but what Ed was famed for was doing things like the Fabian Society and all these like political conferences, and his thing was to speak without notes. But that's because he was at that stage, as Phil said, very much the younger brother, kind of insurgent, the
and
sort
nobody
of
nobody was scrutinising what he was
and
saying.
And people loved it, you know. He was a little bit, I mean, I use this term loosely, he was a bit of a rock star in terms of, you know,
quite
political
ice, you're not spinning from
now. But you know, but then but what Phil is right, I think once you get to a certain level, you don't need the gimmicks and the tricks.
And the upside of doing without notes is massively outweighed by the potential downside of it going
and
wrong.
And always stay at the lectern, as Penny Mordaunt found out very recently. Yeah. Don't go off and start screaming, stand up and fight.
Once you start walking, because you can't
stop. It's really
stop.
Bad. Exactly, it's really bad.
Where's she going? I wish he hadn't stopped. He just walked straight off. But, you know,
walked all the way home because there were no trains. Let's, because we want to make sure, in the interest of completeness, let's wind our way back to 2019. Of course, it was in the middle of all the prorogation, and lots of people actually left, I think, before Jeremy Corbyn's speech. There was all that, you know, where the prorogation was rolled out.
Yeah.
So this was Jeremy Corbyn's speech in 2019, ahead of what then obviously became the December general election. This is him expressing optimism ahead of what actually turned out to be the worst defeat for, 80-odd years. Let's listen to Jeremy Corbyn for 2019.
The tide is turning. The years of retreat and defeat are coming to an end. Together, we can take on the privilege and put people into power. Conference, the Labour Party and our movement, thank you for all you do. Thank you for the campaigning you do. Go forward to win an election for the people of this country.
No one quite knows whether or not his sentence has come to an end.
No, exactly. It looks like he's reaching
forward,
for it, isn't he?
Now,
yeah.
Home.
Yeah, tomorrow.
To campaign.
Yeah.
To prepare election,
for
which is coming.
Defeat.
If that's the rousing end, you wonder what's gone before, don't you?
It was more a stutter than an end, wasn't it?
We have to get special permission to play that clip in the party conference centre so that people could take themselves elsewhere if need be.
I think the other thing that you get from that little clip of Corbyn, and it's the one thing he shared with Ed Miliband, is that they're quite pious in their tone. Mm. And the Labour Party's got to be careful about that, because the Labour Party can sound pious and earnest. And both Ed and Jeremy, in their way, sounded quite pious there. And it's not a really nice look. You know, you're essentially telling people what to do. No, we can be better. There's a sort of patronising part to it.
To be fair, Phil, that is a symptom of left communication. Like, there's many Labour politicians.
I agree, that's my point.
I think I would say, having done comms, I think that's one of the weaknesses of the left, the sort of supply teacher, you know, I'm not angry, I'm just a bit disappointed kind of thing like that. But the other thing about Jeremy Corbyn, and I do think it's a little bit unfair to lump Ed with him, but Jeremy Corbyn was... I'm loyal. But what I will say is, for somebody, you know, for this person that's meant to be a firebrand from the left have often produced some amazing orators, and he was such a bad public speaker. Look, someone like Michael Foot, you might think,
John McDonnell on a good day. I've seen him do good speeches.
Obviously, going back, Bevan was the great speaker.
Or the firebrand union leaders of the left. Many of them have got, you know,
because Scargill was a great speaker.
You know, if you came from the union movement, that was all about basically persuading people to give up their wages for a greater cause going out on strike.
And often sort of gathering people in a car park and making an incredible speech. That was, I think, you know, and when you speak to people who supported Corbyn at the time, they were like, if they picked somebody who had much more charisma and did have those kind of oratory skills, they believe they might have done a bit better.
Somebody who wouldn't read out the notes, strong message here, when delivering a speech.
Exactly. It's one of the great moments in all speech. I'm often tempted when I'm writing things to put things like that in, just in the hope I could repeat that. Yeah. I'll never have a moment like that.
Well... We wait to see if Keir Starmer takes more lessons from Tony Blair than from all the others. And then also we wait to see if it makes the blindest bit of difference in the general election. So it's been lovely to see you both. Phil Collins, Aisha Adewike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Hold up.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.